From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How are you, Joyce? We're recording a little bit later this Tuesday morning because apparently in the middle of the winter, in January, in Alabama, people still mow their lawns. And so there's a bit of noise at your end, right?
We do mow lawns down here. I mean, what do you do? You don't mow your snow or something?
We don't mow the snow. Not even the frost. Well, I'm glad you got that taken care of.
Yeah. Nice guys. They're very good to me, and I'm eternally grateful.
You know, one of the other hazards of podcasting from home is the loudest thing on the face of the earth. Do you know what it is? The leaf blower.
My husband? Oh, the leaf blower.
Is it your husband? Or is it the dreaded leaf blower? There can be a leaf blower in the next town going, and we can't record the podcast. So luckily, there are not a lot of leaves in the middle of winter either. I have a bit of personal exciting news that some people may have heard about.
What's that?
Can we talk about it for a moment?
Yeah. Tell us.
So I have a book. It's called Justice Is. It's for children, a guide for young truth seekers. I didn't draw the pictures. I don't know how to draw. But Sue Cornelison is a brilliant illustrator. And it's basically an introduction to general concepts of justice, which I think young kids are not too immature to learn about. And parents can introduce their children to some of these figures from history who advance the cause of justice. They will learn a little bit about injustice too. Some figures that people know very well and some figures that people don't know very well. And we have Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells and Malala Yousafzai and Nelson Mandela and John Lewis and a whole bunch of other folks illustrated beautifully in this book. And I hope you like it if people want to check it out. I should also say that all the proceeds from the book, all my income, I'm donating to the New York Legal Assistance Group, which is a great organization here in New York that helps children and families achieve justice for themselves. So if you're interested, it's on sale now. It's available at bookstores and online, and you can find all the spots at justiceisbook.com. I need to send you a copy, Joyce.
You know, I'm so excited about this book. My mom taught preschool my whole life and was dedicated to reading to her kids. And so I've decided I'm going to get this book for a lot of friends with young kids, but also for my daughter, who's teaching up in Maine in a community that consists largely of immigrants. And I think it's just, it's a great idea. I'm looking forward to reading it for myself, Preet.
We have one more announcement. I think I mentioned this last week. We have a Cafe Insider referral program. So you can invite your friends and family to join in staying informed and listening to me and Joyce and all the other good stuff that Cafe produces. For every person you bring to the Cafe Insider community, you'll get a free month added to your membership. So if you're interested in that and you want to get some other friends hooked on what we do here, go to cafe.com/referral. That's cafe.com/referral. Now, let's get to some news. There's a lot of issues, and there's a lot of breaking news in the last number of days, much of it relating to the conduct of one or more members of the Trump family. That's basically the theme for this week, and maybe the theme for other weeks as well. But before we get into some of the details, there's something that maybe was not noticed as much as it might have been, and that is there is a friend of ours, Joyce, former colleague, fellow U.S. attorney from the Western District of Virginia, named Tim Hafey. Now, Tim Hafey is not a household name, but Tim Hafey was the general counsel of the University of Virginia school system, which is a very important and substantial job. He took a leave of absence from that job to become, I don't know what his exact title is, but to become essentially the head of the investigative process of the 1-6 Select Committee. Do you know what his title is?
I think he's the lead investigator.
Lead investigator, Tim Hafey, our friend. Why was he in the news this week?
Tim got fired, but not from his job working for the January 6th committee.
He got fired from his job as general counsel of UVA.
You know, it's interesting, right? Virginia's just had a change in its top leadership. They've got a new governor who leans a little bit Trumpy. And the attorney general of the Commonwealth of Virginia, who was technically Tim's boss in his capacity as the general counsel at the University of Virginia, fired Tim and one other self-identified Democrat who is a general counsel in the Virginia higher education system.
So as we understand it, he has the right to fire Tim. Is it unusual? I don't know the history of hirings and firings in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but it sure looks like a political hit, doesn't it?
Yeah, it looks absolutely like a political hit. And, you know, Tim Hafey is just a stand-up guy. He was the U.S. attorney in Charlottesville. He was actually brought on board to write the report summarizing what happened following the death of Heather Heyer during the Charlottesville white supremacist rallies during the Trump administration, did a bang-up job with that report. It was difficult, and he went straight up the middle, just putting together a solid recitation of the facts. And that made him a pretty obvious choice, frankly, for this January 6th committee job. The insinuation by Virginia's attorney general that his initial hiring at the university was somehow tainted or controversial seems just like an excuse to fire him. And so as a proud alum of the University of Virginia, I'm offended for Tim and sad for the university.
So more politics as usual. So we talk about some other stuff going on with the January 6th. By the way, that committee is very busy.
They are busy, right? They worked straight
I'm not worried
Christmas.
About Tim. When the work of the committee is over, he is, as you said, a stand-up guy, super smart lawyer, a lot of integrity. He will be eminently employable at many, many jobs. But that's going to be a bit of time away. And he's got his hands full because every time we open up our phones, there's new breaking news from the committee. Which of those things you want to talk about first? Because there's a bunch. Barr, you want to talk about Bill Barr?
You know, I think Bill Barr is a good place to start. Barr has managed to sort of sit outside of the limelight for the last couple of weeks, but he has a book to sell in the next few weeks, doesn't
he? Let's not mention his book. But what I liked was, I think there was a news report on Twitter about Bill Barr's upcoming book, and lickety-split, true to form, our friend Ellie Honig replied, said, I have an alternative for you, which was, of course, his book, Hatchet Man, unauthorized biography of Bill Barr, in a way. But the weird thing about Bill Barr coming up was, and maybe I missed something, Benny Thompson, the chairman of the 1-6 committee, was doing an interview talking about the work of the committee, and I think was asked a question about Bill Barr. And in response to that question, he said, we've talked to Bill Barr a number of times.
To be honest with you, we've had conversations with the former attorney general already.
You may have seen something more detailed than I saw. It's not clear to me that Bill Barr has testified, is it?
It's not, and I think this is exactly the right place to start. You know, you and I have both had this experience as prosecutors. Just because a potential witness comes in and has a few conversations with you doesn't mean that they're testifying truthfully. Someone can come in and have a conversation with you where they say, I don't recall a whole lot. Or where they tell you, I think that information is privileged and I'm not going to respond to any of your questions. So I didn't think that this meant that Barr was sitting down and giving the committee chapter and verse.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it might even mean, because it was so offhanded, the comment by Thompson, that maybe they've had preliminary conversations about setting up an interview, or maybe he's provided some documents and it's more informal at this stage. So we don't know, but based on what Benny Thompson is saying, it sounds like Bill Barr is, at least at this moment, and this is always subject to change, at least at this moment, is in a cooperative posture. That's not crazy surprising, right? Because his deputies, who ended up taking over when Bill Barr left in December of 2020, we do know have come into the committee's offices and testified at great length and did not assert privilege, if the reporting is to be believed. Bill Barr left a little bit. You know, what's the phrase you would use? Did he leave in a huff?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He left on a timeline that bumps into one of this week's other big stories. And I think he left precipitously is the way that I would
put it. Not enough. That's a nicer way of saying in a huff. It's like,
I'm not sure that it was in a huff.
You wanted to use a bigger word than huff.
I'm not yet ready to paint Bill Barr as a hero. There's some possibility.
Oh, do you think huff implies heroism? Maybe.
He was mad and upset, so he left. Maybe I'm misreading.
Look, I frequently get the meanings of words and phrases wrong, so I'm not sure I'm wrong. But do you think, okay, let's just, one more thing about Bill Barr, and then we'll move on to some of this other stuff. How helpful or interesting or material do you think Bill Barr's testimony would be?
Barr's testimony, if he decided to be truthful, I think would be enormously helpful, but I'm not convinced that the guy who shilled for Trump on the Mueller report has the truth in him. And so I guess I would have to be made a believer. But here's the timeline. Barr leaves right at the time one of our other big stories, this draft executive order, never signed by Trump, but an order that would have authorized seizure of voting equipment and some other stuff, like possibly appointing Sidney Powell as the special interrogator to look into the 2020 election.
How can you even say that without retching?
Honest to God, I mean, this is a week where if the news doesn't make you sick, you're not reading it hard enough. But Barr leaves when that whole scheme is in circulation. And he leaves after giving a public statement where he says there wasn't fraud in the election, there's no reason to seize the machines or to appoint a special counsel. So his departure seems to time up with this memo that we've just learned about because it's one of the documents in that tranche of documents the Supreme Court just ordered release of. So, you know, either Bill Barr prevented Trump from using DOJ to seize the machines, and yay, Bill Barr, or he looked at all of that stuff and said, oh, this is heading into criminal territory fast. It's time for Bill Barr to leave.
Yeah, he said, I'm outie. Or, as you would put it, I shall leave precipitously.
That sounds like Bill Barr. That's something he would
like,
say.
I'm like, huff, left in a huff, I'm outie, left precipitously. I have a couple of things to say about Barr. So is one thing that he might be attempting to do, given the timing of his departure and giving that even he had some limit at some point in the arc of the Trump presidency, that he's engaged in the kind of thing that some other people are engaged in, which is reputation laundering. Now he wants to go back to being a mainstream guy. So I think that's part of it, why he would maybe want to come forward and put even more distance between him and Trump for the history books. That memo, so I'm going to just play devil's advocate for a moment about that memo. I'm not saying I necessarily believe this, but you know, there are some people who suggest that memo, whose language is just absolutely bonkers, and we should actually quote from it. People haven't seen some of the actual language about the seizure by the military of voting machines and all sorts of other allegations that are completely unfounded. But as you say, it wasn't signed. It's not clear to whom it was distributed, how far it went. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Sidney Powell had some role in drafting it, that it was people outside the White House, many of whom were just insane, maybe not medically diagnosed, but in my parlance, insane, like the Kraken lawyers. And so just because some insane people outside of the White House threw some Hail Mary pass and drafted this crazy document that is completely un-American and against the rule of law, how much of that can be blamed on Trump?
I think that's exactly the right question to be asking. Who wrote this and how much circulation did it get? I mean, the only reason that we know about it is because it came to light in a group of White House official materials. So that's interesting.
Right. So that means we know it went to the White House, right?
We know that whether or not Bill Barr actually saw it, he was aware that some sort of plan was in the works because he responded directly to its two key provisions, saying that there's no need to seize the machines, no need for a special counsel. That was what led him to say that there was no fraud in the election. And that's how this draft executive order is phrased. It lays out essentially the big lie as a justification for doing this. So Barr ties up with it pretty good. And it's also very interesting that on this same timeline, all 10 of the living former secretaries of defense wrote jointly in the Washington Post, admonishing the acting secretary of defense, Chris Miller, by name, from interfering in the election. So lots of reason to believe this was in circulation. I haven't seen anything that suggests that Trump definitively saw this or considered this. He never signed it. We should be very careful about defining what a possible conspiracy here might look like and who would be involved.
Yeah, I mean, we do know that Trump did things like call an official in Georgia and say, find me 11,870 votes, right? Like, there's plenty of stuff that we do know definitively, and hopefully the 1-6 committee will get at other stuff. But the thing you're talking about that apparently these former defense secretaries and others may have been responding to was that the order empowered the defense secretary, and it's significant that that's who it empowered, to, quote, seize, collect, retain, and analyze all machines, equipment, electronically stored information, and material records required for retention under, you know, a particular law that related to the preservation of election records, which is astonishing, for among other reasons, there is a longstanding principle of American law that the U.S. military is not supposed to be engaged in domestic law enforcement operations, which this would be an example of. It's one of my favorite phrases. What's that doctrine called? I think we probably pronounce it differently.
Posse comitatus.
Posse comitatus. I think we do pronounce that the same. That's a first for us.
Yeah.
How important a doctrine is that, Joyce?
It's really important. It's one of the first things that I learned about as a prosecutor. And it's not just that there's a prohibition against military interference with law enforcement in the U.S. There are actually criminal prohibitions against members of the military intervening in, for instance, deciding which election ballots would get counted. So this is a really deep principle. And it's weird, I think, in my judgment, that the executive order talks about DOD. DOJ would be a much more logical fit for seizing ballots.
I mean, although they shouldn't have been seizing, nobody should have been seizing anything. Nobody should have been seizing anything.
If I was going to write a conspiracy to interfere with the election, I'd do it through DOJ. That's what makes me think a little bit that perhaps Bill Barr or maybe his successor, the acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, maybe they stood up and said, not at DOJ. Because you know what Trump did after the election and after it was clear he lost was he stacked the deck at the Pentagon. He put in an acting secretary of defense who many people complained at the time did not have the experience commensurate with the secretary's job. He put Kash Patel, straight out of Devin Nunes's shop, in as the chief of staff at the Pentagon and replaced some of the undersecretaries in key positions. So we see this really weird, like, who takes a job after your, you know, boss has lost the election? This whole shifting of characters is really weird and I think understood in the context of this memo. And that perhaps suggests that we need to find out just how far this draft executive order was circulated.
I think that's a great point. You know, that I haven't focused on enough until you mentioned it just now. It's not just the communications that are taking place. It's not just the things that are being drafted, but the shifting personnel, you know, the old guard out and new people who should have only expected to be serving for a few more days or weeks. Why are they so excited about serving in those positions? Maybe they think they're going to serve longer because they're all engaged in one or another conspiracy to turn the election around. You know, one of the reasons we think that Sidney Powell may have had something to do with it, and this is speculation, but it's not crazy speculation, because the draft executive order called for the appointment of a special counsel, which you mentioned before, to oversee this operation and institute all criminal and civil proceedings as appropriate based on the evidence collected and provided all resources necessary to carry out her duties consistent with federal laws and the Constitution. And some observers have speculated that the use of the feminine pronoun her means something. It's not just generic because Sidney Powell had something to do with this. And to remind folks, Sidney Powell is one of the Kraken lawyers who has been very seriously sanctioned by a federal district court judge in the Eastern District of Michigan for, among other things, bringing frivolous lawsuits, none of which, I think none of her lawsuits ever saw success. And this is a person that still had the ear of the president at a fairly late date.
You know, Powell's lawyer has recently suggested that she still believes that there was fraud against Donald Trump in the 2020 election. And although you're right, it's not clear that she wrote the document, sloppy drafting aside, it's consistent, the entire draft executive order, with some proposals that she is reported to have made during a meeting that she attended in the White House on December 18th, that also included Mike Flynn and some of the other of Trump's little spurious cast of characters. What's interesting about Mike Flynn being there, and this is inside baseball stuff, but the memo, the draft executive order, reflects the existence of some NSPMs, National Security Presidential Memos, and at least one of them is not something that was publicly known to exist. And so it's possible, and this is speculation, that this is something that Powell could have learned about from Flynn, who likely would have been aware of the existence of this NSPM. You know, the point is, there's plenty of smoke to investigate here, and somebody, not just the January 6th committee, but maybe with someone with prosecutorial ambit to take a look at a criminal conspiracy, ought to be looking at this too.
That's a good segue in talking about Sidney Powell. to talk about another set of subpoenas that's been issued by the 1-6 committee to four lawyers, Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, Boris Epstein, and one, Sidney Powell. And when I first got news of that and made a comment, I basically hypothesized that none of them are going to show up. They will have some claims of attorney-client privilege. It gets a little muddled when you have lawyers who actually were providing some legal advice contemporaneous with the time period that people are asking information about. But then I saw that Sidney Powell's lawyer, so the Kraken's Kraken, has said that she intends to appear before the committee. I'll believe it when I see it because I've seen that dance before. But if you were Sidney Powell's lawyer, wouldn't you be fighting to prevent her from coming to testify, whether it's justified or not? Wouldn't you be trying to figure out a way, either by outright defiance like some of these other Trump people have done and follow in their footsteps, or assert the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination? Because I think she can only get deeper and deeper in the soup, don't you think?
You know, Sidney Powell was once upon a time a legitimate lawyer with a reputation, the kind of lawyer that, you know, courts of appeals would invite to speak at their circuit conferences. And she's got a real dilemma here, more so than somebody like Rudy Giuliani, who's clearly at the end of his career. She may not be able to survive outright prosecution, right? If she completely flouts the committee's authority, she's running the risk of prosecution, although there is this interesting issue of attorney-client privilege here. And these four subpoenas coming as a group, to me, suggest that the January 6th committee is ready to take on that issue. And of course, we've talked in the past about the crime-fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. You can't cloak a plan to commit a crime by saying, well, I was having that conversation planning to commit that crime with my attorney's advice in the mix. So this suggests to me, especially that they came as a group, that the committee has decided that they're ready to deal with that issue.
You know, on the crime fraud point, I wonder what you think of the optics and also the substance of a lawyer in connection with work that's been done for a client asserts the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. So it's not dispositive, but it seems to be kind of a concession that there's a possibility there was criminal conduct in connection with the representation. But then how is that attorney-client privilege? I mean, I guess you could have a lawyer who, in the purest example, you'd have a lawyer for a client and the lawyer was engaged in criminal activity unbeknownst to the client. So the criminal activity was separate. Maybe it was even defrauding the client. So you would have a lawyer for a client who would assert the Fifth Amendment privilege that doesn't implicate crime fraud. But here, the facts are different.
You know, this comes up and there's case law. I think it's not unheard of for DOJ to indict lawyers or at least call lawyers as witnesses in this scenario involving private businesses that are engaging in fraud. And prosecutors are pretty skillful at parsing the issue and at telling the court, listen, we're not going to inquire into legal advice they gave or business dealings. We just want to focus on these two conversations that, by the way, Judge, we know all the details of, so we know that it's crime fraud exception. And in that case, you can move forward. I don't know how much they know about conversations here. It looks like they know a lot. They've talked to, what, 400-plus witnesses now?
Yeah. They've talked to a lot of folks. And I should repeat again that we focus on the ones who are intransigent, but most have not been.
This, I think, is something I'm looking forward to watching, ready to see this fight happen.
So another group of folks, including one of Donald Trump's children, Ivanka Trump, has been asked, at least for now, to voluntarily come in and provide information. And by the way, one thing I think that's being done very well is in each instance, pretty much, when the committee is either asking for testimony voluntarily or by subpoena, is setting forth the case, is setting forth the basis for wanting the information, is setting forth their understanding of the kinds of information with some particularity that's in the possession of the witness that they're seeking to call. And so in Ivanka Trump's case, and with all these others as well, the lawyers that we mentioned a minute ago, in Ivanka Trump's case, they set forth the basis for the relevance of her testimony, which I think is good. I mean, we wouldn't do that if you were a DA or an assistant U.S. attorney, but you do that in an open and transparent congressional committee setting and process. And among other things, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting about why they're seeking her testimony is that on 1-6, she was a percipient witness to various things, including, they believe, she heard the Trump side of a conversation between Donald Trump and Mike Pence. That's pretty relevant.
It seems that way to me, and apparently the mark hit close to home because it was shortly after the letter became public that our friend Tim Hafey, who's the lead investigator for the January 6th committee, was fired from his job as the general counsel at the University of Virginia. Perhaps those two are unrelated, or perhaps there's some kinship
there. Wait a
minute.
Are you saying that it's possible that Trump called the governor or the new AG and said, fire that guy?
Oh, Preet, I didn't go that far. You just did, though. You know, lots of interesting detail here, as you say. And I do think it's worth noting that the committee has been very level. They are clear to document the sources for the sort of assertions that they make about why a witness's testimony might be important. And I think what they're doing is both educating the public, but perhaps more importantly, laying a predicate for why they need the witness, so that if they have to refer the matter to DOJ for enforcement, they've been upfront from the get-go.
But here's a very basic point that is not necessarily commonly known. There are certain privileges you can assert. There's the spousal privilege. There's the privilege against self-incrimination we've talked about many times. There's the attorney-client privilege. There's the priest-penitent privilege. There is no parent-child privilege.
Yes, and definitely not a daddy-daughter privilege.
Did you see Trump's angry reaction? He said they'll go after the children now. First of all, Ivanka is 40. Second of all, she's not just the relative of the president of the United States then. She was a member of the staff. Third, not that consistency or hypocrisy, you know, matters anymore in rhetorical battles in the United States of America. But Donald Trump, all he did was go after the child of Joe Biden, who didn't have any part of the administration. He even, as someone reminded me on social media, he attacked obnoxiously Greta Thunberg. So he's taking on teenagers, but boy, it goes beyond the pale that an investigation of one of the most serious offenses against the Capitol in the nation's history, that his 40-year-old daughter, who is a member of the administration, shouldn't be asked to come and give information voluntarily.
You know, it's good to know that under the Trump administration, leadership, senior leadership roles in our government were occupied by children. I guess Trump believes that children
well,
are
one,
our future.
One position was, and it was the top one.
Well, you know, I think that that could apply to Jared, yeah, too. Interesting that we haven't seen any sort of subpoena or outreach to Jared yet.
You know, I think they're just doing things sort of tranche by tranche. You know, I'm not sure exactly what the rhythm is, but I'm sure by the time this podcast drops this evening, there'll be other news of other subpoenas or requests for testimony, and we'll just have to see. So one thing that we've talked about for a while, and we mentioned earlier in this show, are these documents that the National Archives has been trying to give over to the 1-6 committee over the objection of the former president, Donald Trump. So the Supreme Court finally weighed in, and these documents were going to go to the 1-6 committee back in November. They finally have gone in the last number of days. And it's kind of interesting. I don't know what you make of it. It was a very short order. There's not a lot of discussion other than on the issue of whether or not a former president retains any authority to prevent the release of documents on the basis of privilege. And it essentially says that they don't have to decide that question because even if he were still the president, which is a little bit odd, he would have lost this battle. But Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, makes it a point to say that there are circumstances in which a former president should have some say over whether something is released or not. It seems to me that the question of the ability of a former president to assert privilege is murky.
I think that that's fair. And this is the most interesting page and a half I've seen from the Supreme Court in a long time, at least since Dobbs, the Mississippi abortion case. They clearly duck the issue of whether or not a former president has any ability to challenge release when a sitting president decides to do the release. I mean, that question is not decided. It's preserved for future cases. What they do say is that even if Trump was the incumbent, they wouldn't block release. And that's a fine argument. The only problem that I have is I don't really read the Court of Appeals holding as saying that. And they say, well, the Court of Appeals decided on this basis, and they really didn't need to decide the prior president issue. You know, that's actually a good legal principle, right? You try to decide cases on the narrowest grounds presented. It's just a really weird reading of the Court of Appeals decision. But frankly, I find myself in agreement with what Brett Kavanaugh wrote here. And I wonder if what's going on isn't this. Joe Biden had a legitimate basis that he set forth for releasing the documents. But what if you had a future president, say one named Donald Trump, who just started willy-nilly releasing papers from the former presidency without a rational reason? And what if a former president then wanted to go to court to prevent that release? I think that it's fair to sort of preserve that scope where if the sitting president doesn't have strong, rational reasons for the release, maybe there should be some scope to challenge. But we know that a normal, rational, functioning executive branch and White House counsel's office is very hesitant to release papers, that they're always very protective of executive privilege for the obvious reasons. And so this notion that Biden here authorized the release just underlines how unusual January 6 was and how worthy of congressional scrutiny. I think the Supreme Court got it right, just in a really weird way.
Yeah, I think that's all right. You know, it's not the case that the lower court said, well, anytime a sitting president wants to release information or the objection of a prior president, that's totally fine in all circumstances and forever, and we don't have to think about this. My recollection is that the lower courts took great pains, as you mentioned, to talk about the uniqueness and singularity of the 1-6 insurrection and how important it was for the public to get information about it and this committee to get information about it. And if it were otherwise, a future President Trump, God forbid, who wanted to release garden variety stuff of an embarrassing nature to some political adversary who emerges, I'm not sure that the courts would think the same.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's right. And even Trump's argument in the Supreme Court was he insisted that as a former president, not, you know, if he had been a sitting one, that he had the right to assert executive privilege. I think the court spent a lot of time talking about the ability of former presidents to assert executive privilege, and the Supreme Court just blew past that and made the decision that it made. But I think it was a good one.
So two other things are going on here in recent days. Trump looks like he's facing some jeopardy in the states. So put the feds aside. We'll come back to the feds in the future. And those two states are my state, New York, and the state of Georgia. In New York, there has been reporting, not just reporting, but release of briefs by the office of the New York Attorney General, Tish James, moving to compel testimony from Donald Trump and Donald Jr. and Ivanka, to mention her again. And then second, in Georgia, he's facing criminal jeopardy in connection with a Fulton County DA's investigation of the election shenanigans in Georgia. Let's talk about those two things quickly.
You know, this situation in New York is interesting. Tish James, the attorney general, is trying to force Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka to testify. And she says that the reason she needs them in this civil investigation that's looking at whether they were playing funny business with valuation of assets and property in order to get financial benefits, whether through taxation or loans or insurance, she says she needs the testimony because she's trying to determine whether the numerous misstatements and omissions that they made were intentional or not. So that's pretty interesting that she's looking at that. It suggests that she may have already decided that she can take some sort of civil action, but it makes criminal action look far from certain.
I think that's right. And remember, by the way, even if it's true that on one analysis, a particular asset looks like it was overvalued, that doesn't settle it, right? There's lots of other subtleties and complications. I'm not trying to defend Donald Trump and his overvaluations by any stretch.
But I think this is fair.
Yeah, look.
No, I think this is all fair.
It also depends on who did the overvaluing. And as you say, whether they intended to overvalue. There is always the defense, particularly and especially in criminal matters, that if you overstated some asset or you didn't pay a particular tax, that you relied on your employees or your outside auditors or accountants or lawyers. And even if they were disingenuous, if they're the ones who said, hey, this is our valuation, just go along with it, that's a defense that works.
And that may explain why James went into so much detail in this late night filing. I mean, it's an unusual filing, but she includes details like the fact that they inflated the size of Trump's penthouse. And so that's something that he would have been aware of, right? The square footage.
Trump inflating the size of something. Who would think? And part of the reason you do that is to make it a deception that is so obvious and so well known to the principal who you're investigating that your argument is, of course they knew. So here, with respect to the penthouse, according to Tish James, he had claimed since 2012 that his triplex penthouse apartment was 30,000 square feet, but had signed documents stating its size is 10,996 square feet. And I guess the future argument will be, do you agree, that of course he must have known the size of his apartment. If his signature is affixed to something, he must know what he's talking about, and therefore the fraud was understood, knowing, and intentional.
I think that's right, and I think she's identified other instances like that. For instance, overstating his liquidity, he would have known what was cash available to him and valuation processes that he would have looked at and been aware of. So I think she's starting to make that case for intent in this filing.
Do you think it's odd that this brief has so much detail that it almost reads like what you would expect an eventual complaint to look like?
Yeah, it is sort of weird. I mean, this is her explanation for why she needs to get their testimony. She's entitled to make those arguments. They certainly opened the door to them by challenging the subpoenas, but she really came in with guns blazing.
So bottom line, do you think she'll get the testimony or not?
I think she's entitled to the testimony. It's a civil investigation. They're the principals in the company. She's certainly shown why she needs to have their testimony. I don't know why they wouldn't be enforced. What do you think?
I think so too. This is not a case like the other occasions we've been talking about where the presidency is involved in any way, where the office of the presidency is involved in any way, where issues of executive privilege, deliberative process privilege apply in any way. This is a private business run in a particular way and a garden variety case of fraud on financial and other institutions. Case closed. Now, the other thing going on, which is a little weird to me also, is you have, and maybe you can explain this to me better, just because you're in a neighboring state to Georgia. The Fulton County DA has requested the convening of a special grand jury. Now, every grand jury that I've been familiar with on the federal side has had the authority and power to approve an indictment, to actually approve the filing of a criminal charge against a person or an institution. My understanding is, which is a new understanding, is that under Georgia law, a special grand jury is one that can continue to convene for many months at a time. So it can do complex investigations. It can hear testimony from people over a period of months and collect a lot of documents and do the investigative aspect of a grand jury's job, but is not empowered at the end of the day to approve an indictment. All they can do, and correct me if I'm wrong, is issue a report recommending an indictment to the regular grand jury. Do I have that right?
I think you do. It's an investigative grand jury for the reasons that you state. The typical state court jury in Georgia only sticks around for a few months, so not long enough for a complicated investigation. They don't use these really often, but this grand jury will have the ability to take testimony. And maybe as important as anything else, there is one judge from the county who is assigned to this grand jury who will hear any disputes. So any witnesses who don't want to show up, anyone who doesn't want to turn documents over, this judge will have the institutional knowledge and will be in proximity to decide those matters fairly quickly and speed the grand jury on with its work.
Yeah, and just so people appreciate, there are real statutes in Georgia whose violation may be implicated by things that Trump and others did, including solicitation of election fraud based on those phone calls and other things. And you and I always make the distinction between the threshold you need to meet to convict someone, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, the threshold you need to arrest someone or get an arrest warrant or get a search warrant for that matter is probable cause. The threshold for beginning an investigation is much lower than that even. And clearly, in this case, there's enough smoke to see if there's fire.
I like this solicitation to commit election fraud challenge because we've obviously all heard this audio tape of the former president talking with Georgia's Secretary of State and asking him to find, what is it, 11,780 votes so he can win the election by one? You know, so it's funny, Preet, I actually wrote the number and printed it out in a really big font and taped it just below the camera in my home studio right when it happened, because I thought, boy, this is really significant. This has to be really important.
Have you made it your ATM pin code? And what bank? What bank do you use?
I haven't done that yet. Good thought, though. But I mean, I still have the same question about this situation that you've raised a couple of times. Why is this investigation falling on the shoulders of a district attorney in Georgia instead of on the federal government? But leaving that sort of pet peeve aside for the moment, the only real question here seems to me, and maybe I'm getting the cart ahead of the horse here on the evidence, the only real question to me seems to be whether this is felony solicitation or misdemeanor solicitation. The Georgia statute suggests that it's felony solicitation and that this grand jury has its work cut out for it.
Yeah, and the other thing to make clear, do not expect anything immediate on the horizon. The special grand jury itself doesn't even begin its work, I think, until May, which is something that I don't really understand why that's true, but that's a long time from now. And then, as we said, they can't indict. So they have to engage in a process, and then there has to be a, and even if they determine that there's good cause for there to be an indictment and the filing of a criminal charge, another grand jury has to do that. So we're talking a long time from now, right?
I think that's right. And look, I'm less worried about that delay because the judge has just signed the order permitting the special grand jury to be convened. That means the clerk's office has to put together a list of names of potential grand jurors. They have to send it out. You usually allow those people a pretty long period of time. Over here, it would be 30 days to show up. The court has to qualify grand jurors, organize the grand jury. That takes some time, and if the judge, for instance, has a big trial on his calendar, that could push it back. So I think it's good that they didn't treat this special grand jury any differently than they would if the target's name was Joe Smith. That seems to me to be appropriate and unbelievably frustrating.
So there's a lot to talk about, as there is every week, but you know, a number of these things are going to be ongoing. We'll keep an eye on them, and we'll be back next week. Don't forget to send us your questions to letters@cafe.com. And don't forget two other things we mentioned at the beginning of the show, that you can get a free month added to your membership if you get a friend to join. And you can learn more about that at cafe.com/referral. And my picture book, Justice is available in bookstores now. Or go to the website, justiceisbook.com.
So all of the above, get Preet's book for kids you love. And we look forward to answering your questions and your friends' questions.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Doss. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.